From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now! Cholera in Haiti. More than 1,100 are dead, 17,000 infected. Protests against the United Nations, which is blamed for bringing the disease to Haiti, continue for a third day. Haitians are barricading the streets with coffins. We'll get the latest. Then a battle is brewing in New York over a controversial federal immigration enforcement program that requires local police to forward fingerprints of every person they arrest to Homeland Security.
The secure community executive order that was signed by Governor Patterson on May 10th is something that he should think again.
We'll also be joined by a man facing deportation to Vietnam. He came to the U.S. when he was 6. He got involved with a gang, spent 17 years in prison, turned his life around, pursuing a master's degree, but he has been given a final deportation order, his only hope, a pardon from the governor. And punk rock legend Patti Smith wins the National Book Award for her book, Just Kids. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A federal jury has acquitted former Guantanamo prisoner Ahmed Khalfan Kailani on all but one charge in the 1998 U.S. Embassy bombings in Kenya and Tanzania. After 5 days of deliberations, the jury found Kailani not guilty on 284 of 285 counts. Although the lone guilty verdict came on a minor conspiracy charge, he still faces a minimum sentence of 20 years in prison and a maximum of life. Kailani was the first former Guantanamo prisoner tried in a U.S. civilian court. Prosecutors had described him as a mass murderer with, quote, the blood of hundreds on his hands. But the defense argued Kailani was a pawn unwittingly exploited by al-Qaeda. Outside the courtroom, Kailani's attorney, Peter Quijano, hailed the verdict.
This verdict is a reaffirmation that this nation's judicial system is the greatest ever devised. It is truly a system of laws and not men. Where in the shadow of the World Trade Center, this jury acquitted Ahmed Khalfan Kailani of 284 out of 285 counts. At the start of this trial, we believed that Ahmed was truly innocent of all these charges. Please understand that we still truly believe he is innocent of all these charges.
Kailani was captured in Pakistan in 2004, taken to a secret overseas CIA jail, then moved to Guantanamo in 2006. At the start of the trial, the presiding federal judge barred the government from calling in their star witness, ruling that information about the witness had been revealed by Kailani while he was being tortured in a secret CIA prison. His trial had been seen as a potential test of the Obama administration's stated plans to try other Guantanamo prisoners in U.S. courtrooms. Newly disclosed figures show the nation's largest health insurance corporations funneled over $86.2 million to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce to oppose health care reform last year. Companies including United Health and Cigna provided the money through their main lobbying group, America's Health Insurance Plans, or AHIP. The spending exceeded the group's entire budget from the year before and accounted for 40% of the budget of the chamber's 2009 budget. The money was used to fund ads, polling, and public events to stir opposition to the health care overhaul. An anonymous source confirmed to Bloomberg News that the money came from insurers because federal tax laws don't require identification of donors. In a statement, the Center for Responsive Politics said, quote, perhaps this key debate would have progressed differently if the true source of the chamber's spending had been known at the time. A new study shows members of Congress saw a boost in personal wealth as the U.S. economy suffered the worst of the economic recession. According to the Center for Responsive Politics, lawmakers' personal wealth increased an average 16% between 2008 and 2009. The number of millionaires rose to 261, nearly half the total members of Congress. The median wealth of a House member topped $765,000, while the average for a senator is over $2.3 million. Democrats have announced they'll force a vote on repealing the U.S. military's ban on openly gay and lesbian service members before the next Congress begins in January. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid says he'll bring a military spending bill with the Don't Ask, Don't Tell repeal attached to the Senate floor sometime next month. The House voted to repeal the ban earlier this year. Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska has claimed victory over Tea Party-backed opponent Joe Miller after more than 2 weeks of vote counting. Murkowski ran as a write-in candidate after Miller won the Republican primary in August. Murkowski is said to have a 10,000-vote lead, but Miller is still refusing to concede the race. The Obama administration's intensifying a push to expand government wiretapping of online communications, including emails, Facebook postings, and internet phone calls. The administration wants Congress to require immediate compliance with wiretap orders seeking government monitoring of encrypted messages sent over the internet. The New York Times reports FBI Director Robert Mueller met with top executives at several major Silicon Valley firms, including Google and Facebook, earlier this week. The White House proposals include a requirement that any services based overseas be routed communications through a U.S. server where they could be wiretapped. President Obama is heading to Portugal for a NATO summit beginning Friday. The Obama administration hopes to drum up support for its military strategy in Afghanistan and a new plan to delay a non-binding withdrawal deadline to at least 2014. Ahead of the summit, the city of Lisbon's undergoing the largest ever security crackdown in Portugal's history. Peace activists plan to hold several rallies, culminating in an anti-war march Saturday. Protest organizer Pedro Lima criticized Portugal's involvement in the Afghan occupation.
We wanted to show the people of Lisbon that Portugal is actually in a war, that we were not even invaded with by that country, that is Afghanistan, and that we are sponsoring that war. Like people, some money is taking care, it's taking out from social and education to be invested in war armaments.
Sweden's top prosecutor has ordered the arrest of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange on charges of rape and sexual molestation. The move follows an investigation that was reopened in September after initially being dropped. It also comes less than a month after WikiLeaks released a trove of classified U.S. military documents disclosing new evidence of torture and civilian deaths in the Iraq War. Julian Assange has denied the allegations and said he's the target of a smear campaign. A Stockholm court is set to hold a hearing on whether to approve the order for his arrest. The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation has launched a probe of around 50 former banking executives whose firms collapsed during the financial crisis. More than 300 banks and credit firms have failed since 2008, but only a handful of financial executives have faced charges. At least 13 people have been arrested in San Francisco at a protest against another tuition hike at University of California schools. On Wednesday, protesters gathered outside a meeting where UC Regents are considering a proposal to raise average tuition 8% or over $800. The Regents approved a 32% tuition hike 1 year ago. One police officer pulled a gun on the protesters, while others used pepper spray to disperse the crowd. The Regents are set to vote on the tuition hike today. Back in Washington, House Democrats have elected House Speaker Nancy Pelosi as minority leader in the next Congress. Pelosi won by a vote of 150 to 43 after facing calls to step aside in the wake of the Democrats' midterm losses. Congressmember James Clyburn of South Carolina will fill a new position of assistant leader under Minority Whip Steny Hoyer of Maryland. Republican senators have blocked a measure to fight wage discrimination against female workers. The Paycheck Fairness Act would increase enforcement of laws requiring equal pay for men and women. But on Wednesday, all Republican senators voted to prevent the bill from reaching the Senate floor. Former Republican vice presidential candidate Sarah Palin has given new indications she plans to challenge President Obama in 2012. In an interview with ABC News, Palin said she believes she can defeat Obama in a presidential election.
I'm looking at the lay of the land now and trying to figure that out, if it's a good thing for the country, for the discourse, for my family, if it's a good thing.
If you ran for president, could you beat Barack Obama?
I believe so.
Maple. And the singer, songwriter, poet, artist, and punk rock legend Patti Smith has won the National Book Award in the nonfiction category for her memoir, Just Kids. The book tells the story of Smith's coming of age in New York and her lifelong friendship and creative collaboration with the renowned photographer Robert Mapplethorpe. Patti Smith discussed her time with Mapplethorpe in an interview on Democracy Now! Earlier this year.
We were the same age, both wanted to be artists, both had nothing, and both sort of on the fringe of things. You know, both of us were more the late bloomer type, and, you know, despite the fact that Robert was, you know, had a very engaging face, he was still sort of a wallflower, a person on the fringe, even in an art school. So we gravitated toward each other and supported each other and evolved together and went through all kinds of things, you know, from, you know, Robert discovering or coming to terms with his evolving sexual identity to becoming a photographer, me evolving from poetry into rock and roll, and we evolved together.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. Protests are continuing in Haiti over the cholera outbreak that has now killed over 1,100 people and infected more than 17,000. On Wednesday, residents in the city of Cap-Haïtien clashed with U.N. troops for the third consecutive day. Crowds have taken to the streets, expressing anger at the Haitian government and the U.N. for failing to contain the disease. Nepalese U.N. troops stationed in Cap-Haïtien have been accused of inadvertently bringing cholera to Haiti. The protests reportedly started at a cemetery where cholera victims were being placed in mass graves. At least two people have been killed in clashes between demonstrators and U.N. troops. On Tuesday, the U.N. mission in Haiti, known as MINUSTAH, said aid flights have been canceled and water purification and training projects curtailed, while food at a warehouse has been looted and burned.
The Pan American Health Organization told Agence France-Presse that the cholera outbreak could kill as many as 10,000 people and cause 200,000 infections in the coming year. Meanwhile, the disease has spread beyond Haiti's borders. The Dominican Republic confirmed it had detected its first case of cholera, and officials in Florida have confirmed the first case in the United States. For more, we go to Haiti right now to speak with independent journalist Ansel Hers. He's in the city of Cap-Haïtien, where the protests are taking place. Ansel, welcome to Democracy Now! Tell us what's happening in Cap-Haïtien.
Right now, I'm facing the downtown public square here in Cap-Haïtien. It's the second largest city here in Haiti on the northern coast, and things appear to be pretty calm here in the downtown. Today is actually a holiday. It's National Flag Day, and it commemorates a huge battle that was waged in 1803 in Haiti's independence struggle. But as I came into the city yesterday, there were barricades almost every couple hundred of yards on the main highway coming into Cap-Haïtien. There were young men as well as women around a lot of these barricades. I had a few rocks thrown at me, but as I got closer, I flashed my press badge and I tried to make clear that I wasn't with the UN peacekeeping mission. And immediately I was sort of hustled through a lot of these barricades. And they're actually still in the streets. A lot of them are not manned at the moment. But people are saying that because today is this national holiday commemorating Haiti's independence struggle, they expect the protesters to come out again in the next few hours. And I'll add, too, that reportedly a third person has been killed by U.N. troops here in the city. That happened yesterday. I actually went by a back street here in Cap-Haïtien where protesters had dug a trench as a barricade, basically, and a MINUSTAH vehicle, a peacekeeping vehicle, fell into the trench. And I'm told by witnesses and by Haitian journalists here that when the vehicle fell in, Chilean peacekeepers sort of came under attack, I guess, or a barrage of bottles and rocks to the population, and that the troops responded with gunfire and shot an innocent young man just in his house. And so reportedly they took his body over to the mayor's office, actually, and left it there. And again, meanwhile, there are still barricades here in the street, and some of them are actually made of coffins. And protesters told me that there are caller victims inside.
We're asking listeners and viewers to bear with the phone sound, but we just think it's absolutely critical to get this information out of Kaypation or Kapasian. Juan?
Well, Ansel, I'd like to ask you, in terms of—it's clear that the U.N. peacekeepers, if they were the source and likely were of the outbreak of the cholera, didn't do it deliberately, but there has been a growing resentment for years now among the Haitian people to UN, the presence of UN peacekeepers. Could you talk about the roots of this animosity?
Sure. I mean, it's been interesting to see how the UN has responded to these riots because and protests, because they've actually claimed that people are sort of being manipulated into this, that it's not a legitimate sort of spontaneous political movement. But of course, I was here in this city a year ago, actually, and I was interviewing people on the street, and there were protests at that time, peaceful protests against UN peacekeepers, and they were telling me that they were tired of an occupation in their country, that the peacekeepers have an enormous budget, but very little of it is spent on, you know, concrete humanitarian activity to actually improve education and healthcare in this country. And of course, also back in August, a young boy, a 16-year-old boy, was found hanging from a tree inside a UN peacekeeping base here in Cap-Haïtien. That's a story that's been totally ignored by basically the entire U.S. media. And UN troops claim that he committed suicide, but people just across from the base at a hotel said that they heard his screams. They heard that he was being strangled. And there's a lot of suspicion that he was, in fact, murdered by peacekeepers for maybe stealing a small amount of money. And then recently, a group of civil society organizations wrote a letter to the UN peacekeepers demanding an independent investigation and condemning what they called the UN's obstruction into justice for that case. And after that death, there were weeks of protests, peaceful protests here in Cap-Haïtien. So the idea that these are sort of manipulated protests, that people are being used, I think doesn't hold water. There have been longstanding accusations against the peacekeeping mission here for abusing Haitians and for lacking transparent investigations into alleged human rights violations.
And what about the upcoming elections and the difficulty of holding an election given the calamities that have befallen Haiti in the past year?
There was a recent report from CARICOM that thousands and thousands of people who died in the earthquake are still on the voter rolls. Of course, the cholera epidemic is spreading. It's been epidemic basically throughout the country. It was allowed to spread out of the central region where it began and is now in all 10 of the provinces. And, you know, even before the cholera outbreak began, you had very regular protests in Port-au-Prince by people in the tent camps, people who've been displaced for the past 10 months, who lost their homes in the earthquake and have not been given any kind of new housing. And their rallying cry again and again has been, we are not going to vote while we're under tents and tarps. And so I think the prospects for holding a credible election where you have considerable participation are pretty low. Of course, one of the largest parties in the country, Famila Valas, the party of the ousted president, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, who was overthrown in a 2004 coup, that party is being totally excluded from the election on what appear to be just political grounds. And it's been part of excluding that entire movement since Aristide was ousted. And so I just think this election is likely to be a sham affair. And yet, the candidates, as well as the Haitian government itself, are insisting, and the United Nations as well, are insisting that this election is going to go forward on November 28th.
Finally, again, the United States holding back more than, the U.S. Congress holding back more than $1 billion in aid to Haiti. What is the effect of this, Ansel?
Is that you have at least 1.3 million people still living in these tent camps, where independent studies by the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti, as well as others, have found that, you know, 30 to 40% of these camps don't have any regular clean water, don't have toilets, and so, you know, I've heard people say that Haiti is unlucky to be hit by cholera, that it's somehow sort of a tragedy that couldn't have been prevented. But the fact is, you know, NGOs, private charity groups, raised billions of dollars in relief funds for earthquake victims after the January 12th earthquake, and very little of it has been spent. Just one example is the Clinton Bush Haiti Fund, headed by Presidents Clinton and Bush. It was inaugurated by President Obama right after the earthquake. They dispersed only $6 million out of around $50 million that they raised. And so the continuing effect is that you just have a exacerbated humanitarian crisis on top of Haiti's decades of poverty. And it doesn't seem likely to end anytime soon unless there's a really serious reevaluation of the way NGOs, in tandem with the United Nations, operate in this country.
Ansel Hirsch, we want to thank you very much for being with us. Independent journalist, has lived in Haiti for more than a year. He's speaking to us from Cap Haïtien, from Cape Haitien in Haiti. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. Back in a minute.
Organisation mondiale, pas pour nous, ça la peau est dévolée, yo pillé dévorée. Les peps qui lundi prend fusil, yo connaît yo bouquet. La médecine internationale, ça met col sous côté. Yo fait réunion, yo parle, yo rancé. Devant vers champagne, bon divin, qu'importe, c'est là s'arrêter. Les peuples envasent tout pays, tout côté. Moi, je m'étends des autres cap analyser. L'aile pas concernée. L'aile pas concernée. Tout ça, mon bab l'étendé, c'est vérité liée. Réactionnaire sous développé, yo sa pi dangereux. L'intérêt yo menacé, c'est yo toujours élé. Toute force interventionniste yo pour peuple qui soulevé.
Organisation Mondiale, World Organization by Mano Charlemagne. He used to be the mayor of Port-au-Prince, a well-known folk singer. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Well, here in New York, there's a battle brewing over a controversial federal immigration enforcement program that more than 700 counties and 34 states have already signed up for. It's called Secure Communities, and it would require local police to forward fingerprints of every person they arrest to the Department of Homeland Security. If agents with the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, or ICE, find that someone is undocumented or a non-citizen with a criminal record, they can pursue deportation. The Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, or ICE, wants this program to be used in every jail across the country by 2013. Earlier this year, New York Governor David Paterson approved a Secure Communities agreement. But his decision has come under heavy criticism here in New York City, home to more than 3 million immigrants. On Wednesday, City Council members introduced a resolution calling on the governor to immediately rescind the Secure Communities agreement. This is New York City Council member Idanis Rodriguez.
The Secure Community executive order that was signed by Governor Paterson on May 10th is something that he should think again. He should revise it. And as a governor that has a important record fighting for affordable housing, fighting for the gays and lesbian rights, fighting on the Rockefeller law, we believe that leaving a legacy of his fight to defend immigrant rights is so important, especially to New York City.
New York City is home to hundreds of thousands of undocumented immigrants who could be affected by the program. Well, at the city's main jail in Rikers Island, federal officials have long had access to lists of foreign-born inmates and detain and deport some 3,200 people a year. But according to a new study of deportations from Rikers Island for immigrant prisoners held on drug charges, suspects charged with lower-level crimes were selected for deportation more often than those charged with serious felonies. In other words, while the Department of Homeland Security claims to be targeting dangerous criminals for deportation, the study found no correlation between the level of offense committed and being targeted for deportation. For more, we're joined from Boston by the author of the report, Aarti Shahani. She's a researcher with the group Justice Strategies. She's a student at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. Aarti, welcome to Democracy Now! Lay out what you found. You just testified before the New York City Council.
I did. Good morning. Well, basically what happened was that New York City Corrections gave Justice Strategies a database of every discharge of prisoners from 2008. We looked at the database, looked specifically at the population of people whose top charge was drug-related, because that's what the report ultimately that we're going to issue is about. But we issued preliminary findings in time for the City Council testimony. And what we basically found is that while Homeland Security claims that they are in the business of public safety, they're trying to partner with jails, with correctional facilities, to identify and deport high-risk alien offenders. This is their language. In fact, what they're doing is just tagging people who happen to show up. What we found in our own study was that of the population of people that are tagged for deportation in New York City jails and Rikers Island, there is not a correlation between the level of your charge and whether you're going to get a detainer or not. And in fact, we found that over a quarter of the people that are being tagged for deportation by Homeland Security agents have A misdemeanors or lower-level offenses than that. These findings came at a very interesting moment. We asked repeatedly Homeland Security to look at our preliminary findings and talk with us about it, explain why is it that you're talking about targeting people based on risk, but really you're just targeting—you're just tagging people who show up. There's a perfect correlation or mirroring between who's in the jail and who gets targeted for deportation. It's practically one-to-one. We wanted to talk with them about that. For several months, I tried to pursue those interviews, didn't get a response back at all. I'm happy to say—or I'm not happy to say, I'm sad to say that the New York Times had the same experience. They tried last week, for actually for a couple of weeks, to get Homeland Security to also comment on my findings, to talk about why is it that this public safety program doesn't seem to have a clear public safety strategy. And again, they promised an interview with the Times, didn't give one. At City Council last week, we were sitting there in the hearing. Speaker Quinn, the other members of the council, kept on asking questions about what's happening at Rikers Island. And it's funny because, you know, these studies that we do from the private side can only elucidate as much as we're told from the public side. And really, Homeland Security needed to be there to ask questions. Surprisingly and embarrassingly, New York City itself, the Department of Corrections, wasn't exactly sure what's been going on in its own jails as well, how Homeland Security, which it's invited in, which it subsidizes the presence in New York City, the Department of Corrections itself wasn't sure exactly what was going on its own turf.
Well, Aarti, I recall about a year ago doing a column in the New York Daily News about a young Mexican immigrant who was in the country, undocumented, coming home on a Friday night from work, and he was mugged and attacked by three youths. He ends up fighting back and slashing one of his attackers. He ends up getting jailed on the crime, and as soon as he gets into Rikers, he's put on a deportation hold. So a victim of a crime ends up not only being jailed for self-defense, but then also being marked for deportation. Did your report find examples of these kinds of injustices occurring in Rikers?
Right. Well, what we actually did was more of a quantitative analysis and then interviewing people about the process itself. But I remember that article, Juan, and one thing that really it raises is that a jail, by definition, is a population of people that are pretrial, that are innocent until proven guilty, or people whose conviction is deemed low enough that their sentence is going to be less than 1 year. So the question of why is Homeland Security trying to have a presence in every single jail in the country is a relevant public policy question. Undoubtedly, at a crime scene, it's hard to tell who victim and perpetrator might be at any given moment, and people get taken in. And then the other thing is, you know, it's not humanly possible, or it's not actually economically or politically possible to deport every deportable person in this country. So this is supposed to be a feel-good program, right? And just to be clear, what's happening right now in New York City is not secure communities. In fact, it's even more developed than secure communities would be in other parts of the country. It's been a longstanding partnership between New York City and the federal immigration authorities, where the immigration authorities basically come in and have access to every allegedly, supposedly immigrant prisoner there, even when that prisoner is pre-trial, even if that prisoner has a low-level charge. The other thing that we found in the study was that people were being tagged. Over half of the people that are tagged for deportation get identified in less than 24 hours. Now, that speed, the brevity of just issuing these deportation warrants, or rather not requests, they're not warrants, the brevity of it indicates that there's not much by way of investigation going on. So, you know, again, this is a question for Homeland Security that, you know, I hope they watch the show and they're predisposed to answer it at some point. But the question is, what exactly is Homeland Security doing to decide who it does and doesn't want to deport? Is it simply a matter of filling up their numbers? Is there actually a strategy there? Because it doesn't look like there is one. Now, on the New York City side, something very interesting that we found is that New York has been extremely generous to the feds, so much so that we're concerned that there is a basic violation or overseeing of basic prisoner rights and monetary concerns for taxpayers. What I mean by that is when Homeland Security identifies somebody for deportation, they issue something called a detainer. A detainer is not a warrant. It's a request that's never issued or approved by a judge. It's simply issued by the administrative agency, the deportation agency. Now, they issue this detainer request, and New York City responds by effectively holding the person on whom the request has been placed for the duration of the case. So let me give you an example. I get arrested on a violation. A violation is even smaller than a misdemeanor. I'm at Rikers Island. On average, for a violation, I would spend no more than two—or on average, I would spend 2 days in Rikers Island. My case would be processed. I'd get a slap on the wrist, and I'd leave. Now, if a judge deems that I'm eligible for bail on my violation, but Homeland Security has requested that I get put in deportation after my proceedings, New York City is going to keep me in jail the entire duration of my case, which is, on average, a little less than a month long. So these additional days where I'm being denied bail on my pretrial case is driving up the costs for New York City. And we found that when you control for race and when you control for offense level, on average, people are spending 73 additional days in jail. That's the associated, on average, increase in jail time with the detainer issuance. And that additional 73 days on average is a cost being absorbed by New York City. And New York City didn't have a clue about it. And that's what's extraordinary about this, is that for what seems like 20 years now, New York can't even identify when exactly their partnership started with the feds. But New York City has given the feds free property, rent-free. Who wouldn't love rent-free property in New York? But they've given rent-free property in New York City to the feds on Rikers Island to go ahead and tag people without any public safety strategy.
Let me ask you about something else.
And
I wanted to ask you about something else. The governor's agreement earlier this year to basically, in essence, expand this program to now anyone who gets fingerprinted or arrested by police. The governor never made an announcement of this. It was discovered, as I understand, through a Freedom of Information request. While he did announce earlier this year that he was going to be open to large numbers of pardons for legal residents who may have been convicted of crimes years back and who were facing possible deportation. The impact of this governor's decision to join this Secure Communities program?
It's a great question, and I don't think that the governor's office themselves know what the impact is of this decision. The Secure Communities program, it's building a car and driving it at the same time, right? And in fact, the New York Times and several other outlets around the country did a couple of articles a week and a half ago documenting the fact that Secure Communities, it's not clear whether it's a voluntary program that localities can choose to sign up with, or is it a mandatory program where the feds are saying to locals, you are going to do this. Early on, since 2008, up until about a month ago, Homeland Security maintained, listen, obviously there are federalism concerns. We, the feds, can't tell you, the locals, what to do. This is a purely voluntary program. But now that they're seeing localities actually choose to opt out, for example, in Virginia and Santa Clara and Washington, D.C., they're seeing localities choose to opt out. It seems like the Homeland Security officials, whether you're talking about Napolitano or Morton or the head of Secure Communities, David Venturella, they seem to be disputing with each other and getting caught publicly disagreeing with each other, contradicting each other about whether this is a voluntary or mandatory program. So what does this mean for New York State, for New York City? I'd be surprised if the governor's office knew, because it doesn't even seem like the feds know.
We're talking to Arti Shahani of Justice Strategies. She's speaking to us from Boston, Juan.
Well, we're joined also here by a man who could be deported any day now. Tom Phan is a 35-year-old who was born in Vietnam and came to this country when he was 6 years old. Tom fell in with a gang when he was 17 and served the next 17 years in prison for his involvement in armed robberies. He was released this January and completed a number of academic degrees during his incarceration. He is now pursuing a master's degree in urban policy administration at Brooklyn College and is working at the Fortune Society, a nonprofit organization that helps ex-convicts reenter society.
Tom Phan has been given a final deportation order. His only recourse now is a pardon from Governor Patterson, who instituted a special clemency panel to recommend pardons for immigrants facing deportation because of old or minor criminal convictions. Tom Phan joins us here in New York. Tom, welcome to Democracy Now! Tell us your story.
Thanks for having me, first of all. And so my story starts off at the fall of Saigon. If you can just imagine a six-month-old pregnant woman trying to navigate the mass of people bombarding the embassy and the consulate gates, that would be my mother. And so, given the imagery, she had to go home. She couldn't make it. 3 months later, I was born under the thatched roof of a straw hut. And then it took 6 years for us to finally save enough money for my mom to pay smugglers to ferry us out of the country. Once we got here, my dad, who was airlifted out of the country during the fall of Saigon, had started his own family and left my mom to make her own way. She went to New York City. We survived off of public assistance. And everything went well. I did well academically in school. However, academics and the social sphere have different competencies, right? So I wasn't I didn't do very good socially. And this happened all the way up until high school when I fell into the gang. And immediately overnight, I became tough, I became accepted, I became protected. But there was a price for that. And the price was to participate in robberies to generate revenue for the gang. I wound up with a 16 2/3 to 50-year sentence. So while once I came into prison, I immediately realized that that wasn't the way to go. I'm not a good criminal. I can't do this, and I had to focus on just respecting other people so that they can respect me, which was what I had always wanted when I was a kid. So I knew that I had to learn things, right? So I learned American Sign Language. I speak Spanish fluently. I have accumulated over 200 college credits, 2 associate's degrees, a bachelor's degree. I walked out of prison. I walked out of New York State Correctional and walked into immigration detention. Because of my convictions, they ordered me deported. And my situation is kind of weird because of my convictions, I was already deported, but because I went to prison when I was 17, I wasn't eligible yet to take the citizenship exam. You have to be at least 18, right? And because my removal proceedings began after the passage of the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, I wasn't eligible for any judicial relief, except withholding under the Convention Against Torture, which has a really, really high bar. And that was the only type of relief that was available. I pursued it. I failed. We appealed it. That lost. So my order of deportation is final. And the only reason why I'm still here is because the federal government is waiting for Vietnam to issue documents for my travel. Once that happens, my master's degree, my career, with the Fortune Society, my work with Families for Freedom will all
You're getting a master's degree at Brooklyn College right now?
Yes.
In?
Urban Policy and Administration.
And so you would be deported back to Vietnam, which you left when you were six years old?
Yeah.
And have you ever been back there during all that time?
I have not been back. I have not been
back. Do you speak Vietnamese?
I know 15 words in Vietnamese. And so we I have conversations with my mom, and I use the same, I use my favorite seven words a lot. And sometimes I have to use English words and then use my seven little words to try to define my English words for her. And it makes for a really funny conversation.
Have you spoken to Governor Patterson?
I have not spoken to Governor Patterson. Families for Freedom had helped me put an immigration pardon packet together. My attorney, pro bono, Sophia Picard, is also helping me with it. And we're just waiting for them to respond. There are thousands of applications in, so I'm one of
this
many.
Is after the governor made this announcement that before he leaves office on December 31st, he's going to entertain possibly hundreds of pardons, especially of immigrants like yourself who are permanent residents, but who have been committed of crimes in the past and have sort of cleaned up their lives and are now contributing to the society.
Yeah, and it's the immigration pardon panel is so important to guys like me or folks like me because it allows us to take our case back to the immigration authorities and say, hey, listen, New York State governor found it worthwhile to give this guy a chance by pardoning him for his crimes. Can you now see to it to perhaps reinstate his legal permanent residency or allow him to apply for certain benefits?
Tom, why do you want to stay in the United States?
It's where I grew up. It's home. It's I listen to hip hop. It's everything that makes me who I am is rooted not only in the United States, but and not only in New York State, and but in New York City. So I'm born and raised in not born and raised, but it's so cliche. But I was raised in Brooklyn. And everything I know is Brooklyn. I've lived in the same apartment forever.
Artie Shahani, Tom was just saying that he had the help of Families for Freedom, which is the organization you founded before going off to graduate school. How typical is Tom Phan's story?
I think it's I mean, everyone is unique, right? But I think that it's a pretty typical story that you have someone who's a long-term resident, a long-term legal resident, that grabs a charge along the way and is now in this situation. I mean, I feel like that had been historically the experience of the people coming through the doors of Families for Freedom, and it continues to be. I feel like that's part of the problem with the way that we talk now about the issue of who ought to and oughtn't be deported. You know, it's like no one can agree on the broken immigration system, so what can we agree on? And, you know, some people would like to say that, oh, we can at least agree that, quote, unquote, criminal aliens should be expelled wholesale. If you're a criminal alien, you have no business in this country. And this came up a lot at the city council hearing, actually, not by all the council people, but a few. And I feel like, you know, what we're hearing now is, and, you know, with you describing your situation, it's exactly the case in point of, you know, people come here, things happen along the way. It's an urban story, right? It's not particular to immigrants. It's interesting to me because I feel like, for example, CARICOM countries, I've been to Port-au-Prince before and after the earthquake, and I think both times CARICOM countries have expressed concern that people leave their countries, their island countries as babies, get raised in New York and Miami, whatnot, in the U.S., fall into gangs, drugs, guns along the way, and then the U.S. wants to ship them back after the experience of growing up in U.S. cities has broken them apart. And so there's also the question of, you know, who should be responsible when people stumble along the way? And, you know, just when I hear this situation, I feel like it's the same question that a lot of receiving countries have as well.
And, Tom Phan, I've often hear horror stories about how folks who go to immigration hearings or before ICE officials are dealt with. What's been the response of the agents that you've dealt with to your particular case?
There has been no response, really. When I went through immigration detention, I was there's deportation officers there who I approached and discussed my situation with them, and the only their caseloads are humongous. So they would just say, just wait, and I waited and I waited.
Well, we will certainly continue to cover your story.
And, you know, if I could just,
we have just 30 seconds, Arti. Go
ahead. I mean, just very quickly, I feel like this story, the study that I did, what these point to continually is that ICE and Homeland Security are toddler agencies. They were created in 2002. And there's clearly no process for accountability towards the individual people that are identified for deportation and the communities that are being asked to partner with them now. So I hope that what comes at the end of this is real scrutiny of the feds, of Homeland Security, and some sort of system of accountability, which doesn't exist at all right now.
We will leave it there. Arti Shahani with Justice Strategies will link to your report. She presented at the New York City Council, now a graduate student at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government, speaking to us from Boston. And Tam Phan, facing deportation to Vietnam. He left there when he was, well, younger than six, came to the United States when he was 6 years old, his mother surviving the war in Vietnam, pregnant with him as she tried to flee Vietnam. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. Tam Phan is getting his master's degree at Brooklyn College and works at the Fortune Society. When we come back, well, the new National Book Award winner, yep, punk rocker Patti Smith. Stay with us.
Take me now, baby, here as I am. Pull me close, try and understand. Desire is hunger, is the fire I breathe. Love is a banquet on which we feed. Come on now, try and understand the way I feel when I'm in your hands. Take my hand as the sun descends. They can't hurt you now, can't hurt you now, can't hurt you now. Wow, 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 wow. Because the night belongs to lovers.
Because the night
belongs to us.
Because the night
belongs to lovers. Because the night belongs to us. Have I doubt when I'm alone? Love is a ring. The telephone.
Punk rock legend Patti Smith singing an a cappella version of her best-known song, Because the Night, here in our studio. She did it just a few months ago when we dedicated our new broadcast studios, the greenest in the country. She was with us with hundreds of people celebrating. Well, on Wednesday, Patti Smith was awarded the National Book Award in the nonfiction category for her memoir, Just Kids. The book tells the story of Smith's coming of age in New York and her lifelong friendship and creative collaboration with the renowned photographer Robert Mapplethorpe. Patti Smith's influential debut album, Horses, came out in 1975 to critical acclaim. Her best-known song, Because the Night, was co-written with Bruce Springsteen. More recently, Patti has performed in numerous anti-war rallies. She's written songs about American peace activist Rachel Corrie, the Israeli assault on the Lebanese village of Kana, and Murat Kurnaz, a Turkish citizen of Germany who was imprisoned at Guantanamo for 5 years. Well, Patti Smith joined us in the studio and spoke with Anjali Kamat and I about her life, her art, her activism, and the focus of her memoir, her friendship with Robert Mapplethorpe.
Well, I met Robert in 1967. Again, you know, I came to New York with nothing. I had a lot of bravado. I had a few dollars in my pocket, but I had a good work ethic. I knew I wanted a job. And that's what I was looking for. And I also didn't feel any fear in New York City. I really loved New York. I was brought up in a very rural community, and we didn't have cars. The roads were dark. There was nowhere to go. You had to have to walk like 4 or 5 miles to, you know, go to a pizza place. And, you know, New York, where everything was right there, there was all kinds of places to get coffee, you could sleep on the subway. You know, it seemed like the safest place in the world. So, and in the middle of this atmosphere, I met Robert quite accidentally. And We were both quite, we were more alike than not. We were the same age, both wanted to be artists, both had nothing, and both sort of on the fringe of things. You know, both of us were more the late bloomer type, and you know, despite the fact that Robert was, you know, had a very engaging face, he was still sort of a wallflower, a person on the fringe, even in an art school. So we gravitated toward each other and supported each other and evolved together and went through all kinds of things, you know, from, you know, Robert discovering or coming to terms with his evolving sexual identity to becoming a photographer, me evolving from poetry into rock and roll, and we evolved together.
And he took the iconic photograph of you on the cover of your first album?
Yeah, he did. He did. And we did that just like we did everything else. Our relationship was built on trust, and you know, sometimes people ask me about how we took this picture like it was some big drama. Like, now you get your picture taken and the photo shoot that you'd think they were doing a movie, there's like catering and, you know four monitors and a bunch of, you know, people running around. It's like a Peter Sellers movie, you know. And really, it was just me and Robert, you know, in a white room and with natural light. And in fact, his light meter was broken. So it was just, he took 12 shots and we got it.
You know, the geography of this city tells so many stories, and Democracy Now! Has just moved from this 100-year-old firehouse, our dear friends, who could think you're calling your landlords your friends, but Keiko Tsuno and John Alpert, I hope they're here tonight, I'm not sure if they are, but really embraced us and protected us until we outgrew this firehouse because they were growing as well, downtown community media center. And so we ended up here in Chelsea, just around the corner from the Chelsea Hotel.
Yes.
So talk about 1969 and you and Robert going there.
Well, first of all, I just want to say that there's nothing better than to be able to say that you had to move because Democracy was growing. So, Robert and I were both, we went through a lot of different things, and in 1969, we were a bit down on our luck. And we had heard that if you went to the Chelsea Hotel, they would often trade art for a room. And we went to the Chelsea Hotel, and I checked out the lobby, and the stuff was pretty bad, and I thought, oh, we won't have any problem. But Mr. Bard was not really interested in our work, but he was interested in the fact that I had employment, which was something that probably 70% of the people of the hotel did not have. Who was there at the time? Well, the first person we met in the lobby was Harry Smith, who was definitely not employed. But we saw all kinds of people there. I mean, there was a lot of artists and writers. Virgil Thompson lived there. I'd say Shirley Clark. I saw Jonas Mekas there a lot, and Allen Ginsberg. And just about, I mean, we could go on and on with lists of people. Even Arthur C. Clarke lived there, you know. So I talked Mr. Bard into, you know, letting us have a room based on the fact that I had a job. We had the smallest room in the hotel, which doesn't even exist anymore. It had no bathroom. It was $55 a week, and I made $65 at Scribner's Bookstore. So that pretty much could say what our living situation was. But it was a really a great stroke of luck to move at the Chelsea, because the people that we met there, Gregory Corso and William Burroughs and Allen Ginsberg, I met Bobby Neuwirth and so many musicians, people you never heard of and people who, you know, we all revere. And I think I said it in the book, but it's true, it became my new university. I couldn't think of a better place to be at the time, because
I learned so much about everything, about painting and poetry, performance, activism, all in this one hotel.
Mm-hmm. 2 years later, 1971, talk about putting poetry to music.
Well, Well, I had my first poetry reading. It was on Bertolt Brecht's birthday, February 10th, 1971. It was a full moon. I was opening up Gerard Malanga and at St. Mark's Church. And of course, St. Mark's Church was the, you know, the mecca for poets at the time. And it was quite an honor to get 18 minutes at St. Mark's Church. So I really wanted to do something special. And also, I knew Gregory Corso really good, and he would really harass you if you were boring. I mean, he would sit in the back, way back there, and if you were boring, you could hear him all the way from back there letting you know that you were really boring. And I asked Lenny Kaye to play some interpretive electric guitar, a little feedback to some of, to certain of the poems. And I didn't think much about it. I just thought, you know, it was sort of like Kerouac and Steve Allen playing together. It's just only with electric guitar. But it seemed to cause a bit of a stir. And I guess that's how it began. Still stirring.
And you talked a little bit about your activism. Some of your more recent music is also sort of builds on these themes. And you had a song called Kana, a song about a detainee who was in Guantanamo. Can you talk a little bit about these songs?
Well, I mean, I would never call myself an activist ever. I hope that I'm a humanist and sort of a good citizen. I really think of the people who are out there in the front lines every day, and I'm so grateful to all of you. I think of activism on many levels, the people that are out in the trenches, and then citizens who can do just small things, the smallest things. And one of the things that I can do is respond to things that are unjust, or and hopefully by putting it out into the world free, putting it on websites, these songs, maybe it'll be of good use. The song that she was talking about Guantanamo Bay, I wrote in response to Murat Kurnaz. He was a boy the same age as my son, and he was detained for suspicious travel. He was German and Muslim, which made him very suspicious after September 11th, and wound up in Guantanamo Bay without any real charges, just a comedy of, or not a very, like a very black comedy of errors brought this boy for like 5 years chained in a very small room, never with the lights out. He had lights on 24 hours a day. He couldn't really lay his whole body down on the floor because his cell was too small, and he stayed there for 5 years. And when they finally did get him out, when he was finally released, he was put on a plane, chained to the floor, with soldiers surrounding him with machine guns and guns, and that was his first taste of freedom. And because he's the same age of my, well, because he's a human being, but also as a mother, I was so horrified by this, imagining, projecting that if this was my son. And so I wrote the song, Without Chains. The gist of the song is it tells his story, but it says in the end, they say I walk strange, because he's walking when he greets his parents. They finally take the chains off, and he fell to the ground because he wasn't used to not having chains. And the song talks about how he now has to learn to
love without chains, vote without chains, dance without chains, breathe without chains.
Patti Smith, punk rocker, now National Book Award winner. You can go to our website for the full interview. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.